What's happening, everybody? Y'all hanging in there and trying to stay upbeat, motivated, inspired amidst this madness? It sure as hell ain't easy. Today's guest is drummer Ash Pearson of Revocation. Ash and I caught up during some downtime where we touched on a few Zappa records and the genius of said man. Ash's warm-up regimen, the writing, recording, and touring of Revocation's last record, The Outer Ones, and a whole lot more. If you're looking to put out vinyl for your project, go on over to my sponsor's website at neworleansrecordpress.com. They got you covered on all things vinyl pressing related, so hit them up, and that's neworleansrecordpress.com. With the entertainment industry so heavily affected presently, be on the lookout to take remote lessons from your favorite musicians, buy some merch, buy some records. Do what you can to keep all these artists afloat in these uncertain times. You can even hit up today's guest and Ash Pearson at ashpearsonlessons@gmail.com. As mentioned previously, shit ain't easy right now. Crash Bang Boom podcast can be found on my SoundCloud, YouTube pages, as well as Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, Luminary, and more. Check out my Facebook and Instagram pages for additional content and updates, and please give me a like, a follow, a subscription, etc. if you could. Support is appreciated. So here we go, everybody. Ash Pearson, part two. It had been a minute, like about 3 years worth of minutes. That's a lot of minutes. Crash, bang, boom.
Crowds go mad with joy.
All right, Ash Pearson, man, what's going on? How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking. I just went and bought myself some groceries. It's a beautiful day, and I just finished making some dinner, and now I'm sort of just enjoying my first beer of the evening and ready to sit down and talk with you about drums and Frank Zappa and all the fun stuff.
Right on, man. It's crazy, dude. Time flies. The last time you and I spoke, we spoke in my apartment, and that was over 3 years ago. So we got some catching up to do. I believe at the time, Revocation played at St. Vitus, and I think y'all kind of just you might have flown in, or maybe it was on the tail end of a tour or something, but you just did kind of, I feel like, a one-off show, because I know you played the house kit that night, and it was, of course, another amazing show. But since then, obviously, you've written, recorded, released, and toured on The Outer Ones. So we'll have to do some catching up on that. But what's been going on over the last month, and how are you navigating the crazy world in which we find ourselves?
Well, the last it's, you know what, it actually hasn't been too bad, I gotta say. I mean, so the good thing for us is that we, in Revocation, we just finished up a tour, and when we got home, they put on like all the travel restriction stuff about maybe 10 days later or something like that. Maybe about a week later, 10 days later. So we didn't have to cancel any shows.
Wow.
Which was great. And the next thing that we had planned was in Europe in August for some festival shows, but I kind of don't think that's going to happen.
Right.
So that being said, we're sort of able to read the writing on the wall and sort of put this whole situation into our plans. But, you know, I know so many people, friends, lots of friends who are just, they were just starting their springtime tours, you know, like starting like in the middle of March, you know, they were in people in Europe, people in the States, they were just about to kick off their first week, the car bomb guys in Europe, Killswitch Engage, Carnifex, all these bands we're all homies with, you know, they were probably less than a week in, and they all had to just change their plans. Devin Townsend, he was out on the road. Everybody had to fly home. Bizarre, man.
Ah, dude, that sucks, man.
Yeah, but the silver lining is it's nice to be home. You know, be with. With my girlfriend, she's working from home. We've been together 13 years, and
wow,
I feel like we're making up for lost time of me being on the road so much. And you know, so we're spending a lot of time together. I'm teaching a lot of online lessons, which I've been sort of kicking it up with that.
Awesome.
So that's been good. And then it's I've been writing and recording lots of demos for all sorts of different side bands, you know, like working on new Revocation music and Zimmer's Hole and a couple other bands that I got.
Gotcha.
And so it's allowed me time to do that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's a silver lining, I guess, with all this shit going on. So
yeah. with the revocation demos and working through that stuff, given the geographic distance between the members, opposite coasts and whatnot, how does that usually work? Is it mostly just people bouncing around whole songs or riffs and then you're recording stuff or all the above?
Yeah. So sometimes Dave will either have a full song or like a good first half of a song, be it like an intro and a verse and a chorus or something like that.
Yeah.
And then usually it's something that tends to germinate, and him and I, we never usually go more than a couple months without seeing one another on an average year, just because we end up touring.
Right.
And then when we're on the road or something, we at least have verbal discussions about, hey, that song I got, I'm on a practice pad or something. We're warming up for a show, or maybe on some of the rehearsal days that we have before we go out on tour, we run through some of the new material.
Right.
But for the most part, we end up doing just like Skype kind of stuff where he sends me just guitar track versions of a song, of a new tune. And then we talk about, the skeleton of maybe, is this a thrash beat part? Is this a blast beat part? Mm-hmm. Is this a part where there should be a cool fill and all this stuff? And we talk about these things. I write them down. And then I go and record my first impressions and then also what we discussed, you know? And then I sent him to him. He's like, this part's really good. This part I'd like to have maybe a more complicated fill there. Or this part I'd want you to actually match this thing I'm doing a little bit more. So it's a back and forth where we just talk about the files. It's a file sharing thing, you know? And it seems to work. I mean, it's the wonders of modern technology.
Yeah,
you can get an awful lot done, if you have a system.
Right, that's the thing. Well, and speaking of the Outer Ones, tell me a little bit about tracking that record, and maybe if there was any particularly challenging sections or scenarios that you ran into. You strike me as someone that's pretty prepared going into the studio, so I don't know if you've ran into any roadblocks or hurdles. But I guess just tell me a little bit about where you recorded it and the experience of recording it, because there's definitely some killer drumming on it.
Totally. Thank you. Normally we record everything with Zeus, our producer, but there was some scheduling conflicts with recording the drums at his studio. So we ended up going with this guy. Shane Frisbee is his name. He works out of Cape Cod, I think it was.
Okay.
It's one of the islands. There's Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, it was a really nice place. It was like he had like an outfitted barn in his backyard that was like a studio.
Wow.
And, it wasn't a barn in the hay and chicken coop sense. It was just like, it had that shape, but it had a control room and a nice drum room and all this stuff. And, it was a pretty cool little setup there, man. And, we stayed at his house.
Nice.
Just right across the way. And, it was a pretty fun experience, we would cook dinner in the evening, we had bunk beds and the whole basement to ourselves with like a pool table and fridge and all that stuff. I drink maybe like 5 or 6 espressos every single day. I'd take a short break, I'd drink some coffee, I'd be eating like granola and stuff like that and just slamming water and then drinking coffee, and I'd just be drumming like all day long for like 8 hours a day or something, and I had a great time doing it. So that the whole experience of doing it was really fun, but then tough sections. There's like a little drum solo thing I do in the middle of Vanitas. I think it's like the 6th track or something like that.
Yeah.
A lot of that was just, we sort of did on the fly and we tried a handful of different ways. It was meant to be a solo, right?
Right.
And so we did a whole bunch of different passes at that, and we sort of built on that. That one took a little while to put together and get something that was good that we were happy with. But everything else, was pretty well prepared for the most part.
Yeah.
Dave is in there too, helping me out. Being like, yeah, that was great. Maybe try it. I want to hear, try it like this, try it like that or whatever. So there was just like a whole handful of suggestions being thrown my way. Yeah. But all in all, it was actually a pretty fun experience this time around.
Yeah. It sounds like it. That's what sounds amazing.
Yeah, man.
Tell me a little bit about, I guess, Torn on the record, because I guess you had probably, a couple years worth of Torn off of that record?
Yeah, we did. And, yeah, man, we got some pretty good mileage out of this one for sure.
Definitely.
We had some plans for fall, for summer. Nothing too crazy, but yeah, we got a good 3 years out of this album cycle, I think. And
wow.
Some really good tours, man. The Voivod thing that we did was fantastic. Yep. You were there, right?
I was. Yeah, that was amazing. Voivod was especially great that night. I think from being on a bill with y'all and Psychroptic and some of those bands, they played like their thrashier, kind of heavier set. They were awesome. I'm a massive Voivod fan anyway, so that was just great seeing them. And I loved the whole bill. I thought was amazing.
Yeah, man. Those guys are sweethearts. They're legends. They're fantastic at what they do. They were so good every single night, and they were a pleasure to share a bus with. And then, actually, so that was the New York show that you saw, and that was the very last day of the tour.
Right.
And then we were set to fly home for a month and then go to South America for about 2 weeks after that. But it ended up that we got a really killer tour offer to be main support for Killswitch Engage.
Ah.
And so we ended up having to... We ended up working that into our touring plans, and that was in relative terms pretty impromptu, because normally you have at least like 3 months mm-hmm. of a window where, you know, there's an offer, there's a tour offer. It's, say it's January. Do you want to go on tour in April mm-hmm. or something? Like, you know, that's kind of how it normally works. But we only had about a month or 6 weeks tops worth of prep. Mm-hmm. I think it was less than a month, I think. Which, you know, we had to scramble and book plane tickets and logistics and, you know, bus and all this stuff, crew, right?
Yeah.
But that one ended up being really good. So, so we played New York, and then we went right to JFK and flew to Europe. And then was playing a show like a day or two later. And then, and then right from there, we went straight, you know, to New York from Europe, and then flew to Mexico. And then continued this whole tour. So it ended up being almost 3 months long.
Wow.
And so, you know, that was actually pretty fun. It was a total adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, man, we had some really good, touring opportunities on this one. The songs and the material was a blast to play live,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was my second record with the band. So that also felt like a cool sense of accomplishment. Like, you know, the fan base is more familiar with me and my playing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got to, it was my sophomore record, I think they'd call it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so I also felt more of a sense of confidence and whatnot with the parts that I had written, and then also my ability to play them live. So, you know, that new batch of songs was really a joy to play.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah.
Well, when, you know, I know y'all played, in addition to playing the record in its entirety, I believe when I saw y'all, you obviously went back in the catalog and played some other jams. And when you originally joined the band, and even to this day, revisiting some of those previous songs that Phil played on, was there any particular songs that was a little odd to you, or maybe a little challenging? And you know, sometimes when learning other drummers' parts, you realize, you know, that's not something that I would do. And then you kind of have to obviously get in that headspace of doing it. So was that a bit of a process, or did it come pretty natural to you?
Pretty natural, because I had been doing it for years already.
Mm-hmm.
Not just with Revocation Music, but when I first joined 3 Inches of Blood, I had to learn a whole back catalog of drummers' parts and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had to fill in for bands, or even just like when I was teaching myself to play drums, I was learning to play along to records and trying to match a whole array of different drummers' kind of general styles. So, you know, I mean, yeah, sure, maybe there's some beats where it's like I might have changed a thing here or there just to fit my sort of style, but it was never very much because of a limitation. It was just more because of a stylistic choice.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, there's some, like, we played, I think Existence is Futile is an old school song, and Madness Opus. Those songs are so much fun to play. And I love the drumming on those records,
yeah,
and on those songs, and it's a feast to play. And I mean, I really feel like I've made those songs my own. Mm-hmm. Now, just, you know, it almost feels it feels totally natural to play that stuff. And I think like most drummers, they're used to being chameleons of sorts. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
You got to adapt to a style. You got to adapt to a different drummer, different drummer's parts that you're trying to recreate and stuff like that. So, yeah, I feel like I've been doing this for a long enough time where I can kind of fill different kinds of shoes as is needed, you know?
Totally, totally. Yeah, I mean, I thought, to your point, I think in hearing you play the stuff that obviously you've been on and reaching into some of that back catalog, it all flowed really seamlessly, and it sounded like you were pretty much at home with everything. And in particular, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was I noticed that while playing it, you really seemed to really stay calm. And I spoke to you briefly about it after the show, and you were telling me about just like breathing and kind of getting control of that, because you know, just being amidst such chaotic music and such high energy music, you kind of really have to be focused on that, because you could blow yourself out pretty easily early on in the set. So tell me a little bit about, I guess, maybe you focusing on breathing and just staying calm amidst all of that, and you know, how you got to that point.
You bet. So a part of, one of the main parts of my warm up, or at least where I start, is I'll hold the sticks and I'll exert the minimum amount of influence on the stick to make it move. So I'll hold it down like completely flat on the pad, and then I'll move my hand and my fingers and my wrist only so much as needed to sort of lift the stick and then to let the stick bounce. Uh-huh. You know?
Yeah.
So I try and get a bass line. So I don't start by playing loud, and I don't start by playing fast. I start by playing really just like light, because that's what I want to get my body back in touch with, is the ability to exert a small amount of influence and get maximum kind of effect, mm-hmm, out of things, you know?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to be working too hard. I don't want to, you know, do any of that stuff. So that's where I start. And then I start to, you know, I'm getting back in touch with, you know, bounce, mm-hmm, bouncing the stick. Chris Penny, shout out to him. Part of his warm up, he's like, I don't try and learn anything new. I just try and reinforce the things that I'm going to be using and the stuff that's helpful for me and my drumming. So I'll do that, where it's like, I bounce the stick, I do like, you know, maybe 8 on the hand, or I do like a minute or two on the right hand, minute or two on the left hand. Mm-hmm. And then I start to, interlacing single strokes. I'll do doubles, paradiddles, inverted doubles. And then I'll do things like flams and drags and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And really just try and reinforce my dexterity. Mm-hmm. I do like shin raises, where it's like I plant my heels on the ground. Mm-hmm. I don't always have time or a chance to use like a kick pedal practice pad or anything like that. So when I warm up my feet, I'll do, put my heels on the ground, and I just lift my toes up while keeping my heels planted on the ground. And I slowly stretch out my shins, because I'm usually walking for the better part of the day. So my calves are, you know, in pretty good, they're usually pretty warmed up in general. Mm-hmm. So it's my shins that I start to try and pump some blood into.
Yeah.
And, that's part of my warm-up routine for my legs. And then same with, like, I'll put the ball of my feet on the ground and I'll raise up my heels, and then I'll just do like a sort of a twitchy kind of a motion that is, you know, kind of mimicking like a swivel or something like that. So I can sort of break off some of the adhesions in my leg and just get some blood flowing to the area. Mm-hmm. And then I'll start to put on like a metronome, you know, maybe like I'll start at 190, and then I just like rip on that for like a couple minutes back and forth, and I bump it up and I try and get to like 220 or 230.
Wow.
And then the first song that we play is at 187, which is the outer ones. And And that's also part of my warm-up, you know, where I don't... I'm getting the turnaround of our set list a little bit.
Yeah.
Otherworldly Origin is our first song.
Okay.
And that's at 225, and that's just a straight blast beat, so...
Right.
Yeah, and then... I got to remain calm. That's a big part of it. I kind of look like I'm baking a cake up there sometimes, you know, where I'm just, you know, I mean, your arms are just hanging at your side and your arms and your elbows are meant to move around your hands across the kit, mm-hmm. and your hands are the players.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just try and keep in mind things like economy of motion, breathing, technique. Note values. I try and hear the note value that I'm going for in my head, so I'm not. I can actually imagine the sequence of notes that I'm trying to achieve, and so as to not, you know, overdo the amount that I'm trying to play. I'm not trying to overforce like anything, and I'm just trying to essentially just chill, because you got lots of adrenaline pumping on you.
Right.
When you're playing a show, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of that. And then, but you also got to learn to, you know, chill out and then perceive what the click track is trying to tell you should be playing, and just play it with confidence and calm too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Very zen-like kind of thing.
Right, totally. I got that from you. And I think it's interesting that you told me that, because in listening to you play this stuff, I thought that some of that zen-like nature that you seem to be embracing might have been manifested itself in the way you were grooving in the stuff. Because generally, I think, you know, oftentimes with music such as what y'all do, whether, you know, just extreme music in general, it has a tendency to be a little stiff and a little overly quantized, even in the live form of it, just very much kind of on top of it. But
yeah.
You seem to kind of have a comfortable sort of pocket that you're able to convey somehow amidst all that, which is not very common. So that's one of the things I dug about your playing that night as well.
That's very kind of you. Thanks, man. And you know what, Brett Bamberger, our bass player, he always says that he loves my bounce.
Uh-huh.
He says I have a real nice bounce to my playing. And I think that's kind of like, I mean, to me it feels natural, but it is a bounce. Mm-hmm. It's a groove. It's a wave, you know, like, music isn't like a pogo stick bouncing up and down,
right.
You know, it's more like of a action reaction, up and down, wax on, wax off, yin and yang,
mm-hmm.
all that kind of stuff. There's always a flow and a forward momentum to music, just like straight up.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I think of it. And I think everything, Even insane death metal at 260 has the ability to groove and stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
I truly believe that. And that's where, I mean, I learned most all this shit I know from, well, I don't know. I mean, I reach out into a lot of different avenues to try and inform my drumming. But Gene Hoagland taught me a lot.
Of course.
You know, he was my teacher growing up,
right.
And I'd take lessons with him in private and stuff. And he taught me a lot, but his general demeanor was that of a very calm, confident individual.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took martial arts for about 10 years or something like that.
Mm.
And I learned a lot about, you know, moving your body around and efficiency and power, where power comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And all this stuff, how size doesn't necessarily matter. It's things like physics that govern movement,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And so if you can, you know, if you can relax and use exert force and energy only as is needed and at the exact right time,
mm-hmm.
then you can achieve some pretty devastating results. You know?
Right, totally. You mentioned Gene Hoagland, and one of the things that I was going to ask you about is in regards to triggers and using triggers live. 90s Cynic and Death Records with Gene and Sean Reiner and whatnot, I think that they seem to play some pretty fast, pretty shredding stuff, and not necessarily to my knowledge with triggers. So I was just curious as to your application with them and sort of how you use them, etc. Or do you use them?
I do just for the kick drums. I don't really believe in using it for the snare drum,
right.
Or the toms.
Yeah.
But then again, I've also seen people use it to a pretty good effect, where they use it as like a supplementation of their sound,
right?
You know, on the toms and the snare.
Hmm.
But in general, I think you should just use them on the kick drums.
Yeah.
That's just my taste. That's what I think right. they should be used for.
For sure.
A lot of it's like a frequency. It's a frequency thing as well. You know, it's hard to make. You know, if you only had a minimum mics that you could use, you'd use a mic for the vocalist because they need to be heard. Mm-hmm. But the next thing you'd probably want to use is for a kick drum, you know?
Yeah.
Because everything else in its own way could probably translate well and still serve the music. But if you can't hear what somebody's singing, they need to be mic'd. And if you can't hear what the kick drum's doing, then the pulse is like lost or diminished, you know, significantly. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think triggers are very useful, especially in metal. They occupy a little bit more of a mid-range frequency in order to rise above a lot of the low tones that metal brings right. to the game, mm-hmm. and they get to assert, you know, their role with a little bit more control from the sound man, and sometimes they can be a really great thing, man, for those throw and go shows. Where you don't have right. enough time to dial in a good sound, let alone a good kick drum sound. So you just mm-hmm. like, you don't even need to mic up the kicks. You can just like plug in your trigger and you can get a pretty badass sound if you got a good sample.
Yeah.
But those 90s records, yeah, I don't think they were, you know, they probably used several different mics, you know, some mm-hmm. on the inside, some on the outside, you know, just really good mixing, really great playing. And, you know, you can get an awful lot of attack, you know, out of mics. You know, you put a flat Beta 91 inside the kick drum and mm-hmm. like a D112, mm-hmm. you know, and then you can get a fat kick drum sound that has an awful lot of attack that sounds just like a trigger and vice versa. So, actually, you know, what's funny is like, I don't think Gene uses triggers anymore, but I saw him play with Testament last year, or whenever that Slayer thing was, the mm-hmm. Slayer tour that they did.
Yeah.
And he was using, this was in Europe at Hellfest I saw him play. And he was using, not triggers, but so a kick drum skin that was like, you know, that he wasn't using anymore. He cuts off like a square strip of it and then tapes it to where his beater is hitting his kick drum,
wow.
his normal kick drum skin. So he has his regular kick drum skin as you would expect it, except mm-hmm. where, you know, where the, like an AF patch would be, or like right. he has the top part of a skin taped.
Right.
A small square of a kick drum skin taped where his beater is hitting.
Right.
But he only has the top part of it taped. So when the beater's not on the head and the beater's like coming back,
mm-hmm.
the small piece of skin that he has taped on there sort of flutters back out again.
Wow.
And then he slams it down. It's really weird. I've never seen it before, but it's it adds a little bit of extra slap, I guess, mm-hmm. onto the kick drum, where it's like it's a skin hitting another skin with a beater behind it.
Right.
And I guess it adds more attack.
Right.
I've never seen it, but it sounded good. It didn't seem like it slowed him down at all. That honestly, that would feel a little bit weird to me, but
yeah.
But it seemed to work for him. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Damn, man.
I dig triggers. I like them. Long story short, I like triggers. Yeah.
Gotcha. You obviously, in speaking about double bass and whatnot, I was just curious if you've went through periods where you really focused on double bass exercises and independence, et cetera, specifically, because it's kind of funny, you know, if I go a stretch without playing drums, and because, I mean, I'm going on 30 years of playing drum set, but probably double bass maybe like 6 years or so. So it's the most recent skill set. But it does seem to be the first to get sloppy if I don't kind of keep up on it. And I'm just wondering if you've had the same experience, or if it's so embedded in you that double bass, you know, you don't have to necessarily really like focus on specifically keeping that skill set up.
Nah, it's something you definitely need to maintain, especially if you want to play at a really like high level.
Right.
And I don't as much as I should. Like, my friend Alex Rudinger, he does a high intensity drum warm up every single day of his life.
Wow.
Regardless of whether he's on tour, going on a tour, any of that shit, he does the same thing. It's like maybe half an hour to 40 minutes where he's playing like, you know, high tempos for a long period of time, and he stays in shape all the time, right? You know, I do not do that. I get back into extreme drumming shape when it comes time for me to go back out on the road. And in general, the other stuff that I pursue is more dexterity based and then stylistic things, you know,
right?
Other just style based stuff that I want to pursue that I feel makes me into a more well-rounded drummer.
Right.
So the things that I do for maintaining double bass stuff, whether I'm on the road or when I'm leading up to going on a tour, is kind of like endurance based stuff, isolating each foot,
mm-hmm.
You know, and then you put them together, and then you can do short roll combinations,
right.
Short roll exercises, mm-hmm. where, you know, you're playing eight right foot, and then you lead with your left and do a short roll.
Right.
And then eight with your left foot, and then play a short roll leading with the right. You know, just mm-hmm. these little things that reinforce left foot lead, right foot lead, and so on and so forth.
Right.
But yeah, man, double bass drumming is definitely a discipline, you know?
Yeah, totally, man. So I know the last time you and I caught up, we talked a little bit about Zappa, and I actually went back and revisited the episode a little bit, and I know that I had given a shout out to my kind of favorite four of his discography, being from, what was it, 73 to 75, Overnight Sensation, Apostrophe, Live at the Roxy, and One Size Fits All.
Yeah.
But I'd love to delve into a little bit of those records. So, you know, and it's so crazy when I think about it. I mean, as I don't know if you know of anyone that could be considered to be more prolific than Frank Zappa, but I mean, to my knowledge, I believe it was 62 records in 27 years. And then all the posthumous live recordings and everything else. So it's like, you know, I mean, my God, how is that even possible?
I know. Yeah, man, it's insane. Like, yeah, and it seemed like a novel idea, but he was a composer who used a rock band as his orchestra.
Totally, totally.
Yeah, and you know, there are more prolific people out there. To be fair, but they're like composers in a traditional sense. I mean, someone like John Zorn has made an awful lot of albums. You know, there's tons of people, but not necessarily people who are, you know, guitar players and singers in their own right, you know, just like making album after album after album. I mean, he did three albums in 1972 alone. He did five albums in 1979 alone.
Oh my,
you know?
God.
It's like insane. I mean, although it's part of, you know, Joe's Garage or whatever.
Right.
But it's still considered like two different. I mean, hell, even four albums in a year is like fucking. Who does that? You know,
it's insane.
And yeah, for sure. And they're all pretty good. You
right,
know,
right?
So that's another thing.
totally, man.
Yep. He's an enigma, man.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've kind of joked that I can't imagine a scenario where Zappa was not sort of on the spectrum of some kind, some sort of high functioning, some sort of spectrum, something or other, you know? I mean, it just, I would imagine that was the case, you know? And it's kind of funny because I kind of have my holy trinity of guys that might have been high functioning sort of spectrum guys. And I love Jeff Lynne from ELO, who, you know, he would write all the songs, produce the records, masterful singer, orchestrator. Yep. And then, of course, Danny Elfman of Oingo Boingo. And then, of course, all the Tim Burton movies. I'm like, if the body of work from some of these guys and what they accomplished is just, I'm like, well, I guess they're special human beings, clearly.
yeah, they are special, and they should be celebrated, man. And I'm glad you're down to celebrate, you know, frank with me, you know. Yeah.
Fuck yeah, man. I guess we could we'll go chronologically if you want. So we could start with Overnight Sensation and a really hilarious record. Some of the more ridiculous lyrics and song titles, and that's coming from somebody in Frank Zappa who constantly wrote crazy lyrics and perverted song titles and everything else. But I mean, from Dynamo Hum to Montana and Camarillo Brillo, and then it's got the funky tracks of Dirty Love and I'm the Slime.
No.
I think... my personal Frank Zappa, maybe all like my favorite guitar solos. He really rips a sick ass solo on the song 50-50.
Yeah.
And there's a keys solo, then a violin solo, and then he just rips this crazy thing. He sounds like an absolute crazy person, but I love it, man.
No doubt. Hell yeah. Yeah, you bet.
It's so sick. And then there was one, and then the following one, obviously, you have Apostrophe, and we can talk about one of the passages and a song that you had mentioned, you know. You had another crazy record, of course, Eccentrifugal Force.
Eccentrifugal Force.
There it is. F-O-R-Z, because he's such a weirdo.
Yeah.
The Rippin' title track. It's got another great guitar solo and all kinds of shredding on it. Then there's that really absurd melodic percussion section in St. Alfonso's Pancake Breakfast, which then leads into the song Father Oblivion, which is... you know, another great song.
Yeah.
But yeah, what is going on with that melodic percussion section? That section is just outrageous.
Yeah, there's a great version of the marimbist Ruth Underwood. So they did a classic albums installment of Overnight Sensation and Apostrophe.
Uh-huh.
Did you see that at all?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, dude, you got to check it out. It's Dweezil and Joe Travers, who was the Zappa Play Zappa drummer for several years.
Right.
He's the guy who's the Vaultmeister who keeps track of, takes care of, and of all the master tapes of his shit. So he's taking care of the Zappa vault of recorded material.
Oh my God.
And so it's Dweezil and Joe Travers sitting behind a soundboard, and they do stuff like isolate tracks, right?
Oh,
so they'll isolate you know, the like a vocal track or something.
Oh, yeah.
something like 50-50.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Overnight Sensation, Tina Turner sang on on one of them too,
right.
and her and the I Kets, I think it is.
Yeah, I forget which one, but she's definitely on it.
Yeah, yeah, she sang on I Am the Slime on Your Baby,
right.
You know that one. That's her.
Wow.
Dirty Love, she was on that.
Wow.
And then she was on, I think, Zombie Wolf. You
right.
know, telling you all the zombie truth.
Yeah.
Here I'm is like all the females you hear on that. That's Tina Turner and her Iquette. So,
wow.
You know that they talk about that kind of stuff. They isolate those people on the soundboard, and then they also have some little interviews with people who also played on those records, like George Duke,
right?
Rest in peace, and like Ruth Underwood, who played percussion and marimba and vibraphone. She
right.
She whips out the sheet music, and then she plays the part for you too. So,
oh right.
That whole part, it's called like Rollo or Rollo Interior, I think she said it's called.
Okay.
And so originally it's only marimba, I think, and keyboards on the album, but then Dweezil learned it on guitar. So when they did it live, it was keyboard, and he played the part on guitar as well. And then the percussion side of it as well. So he sort of took that and transcribed it to guitar and, you know, stepped up and did that, which is pretty cool. But originally it was just, I think, marimba and keyboard, but
right.
Yeah, man, there's some really, really cool stuff on those albums alone. And I think that's why they did classic rock, classic album episodes, because they happened like basically back to back, you know, what is like September
right.
of 73 and then March of 74. So they're only like, you know, about 6 months apart, give or take, oh maybe like God. A little more than that. But, yeah. And they're both very accessible, you know,
yeah.
In terms of the material, that's some of the most like accessible Frank Zappa that you'll probably ever find, you know?
Right. Right. Which is wild. Like that's how crazy or how relatively crazy his music could be, that this stuff, which is by most accounts, pretty fucking outrageous, that this would be like yeah. the more like quote unquote in or accessible music that Zappa did. It's so outrageous. Oh my God, man.
Yeah. 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 Well, yeah. Totally. What does that tell you about the guy?
Seriously. And then, of course, the third one in there would be Live at the Roxy and Elsewhere. And, you know, the funny thing about that one is that I had kind of stopped. I started with Freak Out and then just kind of went forward, you know, from 66 up to like maybe early 70. I might have stopped with like Live at the Fillmore East, which I believe was 71. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of was like, all right, I got enough Zappa stuff, you know, and I didn't know about this period. And then this was, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago or something like that. But I was literally like out in a trailer out in the woods in Southeast Louisiana. And my buddy floored me when he played me this record. And I was like, oh, shit, there's a whole another phase of this band that now I need to delve into. And yeah, man, I mean, the second I heard from Pygmy Twilight and my God, Don't You Ever Wash That Thing with all the drum solos and of course yeah. Cheapness and Bebop yeah. Tango. And, you know, not to mention this was basically a live record with all original music not previously released as far as I know. So it's as if he wrote like an entire show specifically with these songs. And it's like, who does that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. One of my favorites is Village of the Sun
oh,
and
yeah.
Echidna Zarf.
Oh, Echidna Zarf is amazing.
And so like More Trouble Every Day is kind of like, I think that it's like a continuation of Trouble Every Day, which is on Freak Out, right? So
right, right.
There's some stuff on Roxy and Elsewhere where it's like pre Inca Roads or something like that, you know? That uh-huh. every like you hear like the initial idea of some of the uh-huh. stuff that that he did, and then he turned it into a song. So like I think there's like some live recordings where he takes like for example just a little like a verse of a song, and mm-hmm. I think I remember hearing. I'm like, oh man, this is Inca Roads, but this isn't that song. It's just some like vamp they're doing live.
Right.
And then he just like, you know, a year or two later, like expanded on it and made it a full blown song.
Right.
So there's a handful of that flying around in this record, I think, where there's a little bit of some like Easter eggs or whatever.
Yeah.
But Penguin in Bondage, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was always a fan of, yeah, well, Pygmy Twilight,
oh,
definitely.
Yeah.
The Bebop Tango. So I got a story about that, because I used to dress up like Tony Clifton for Halloween and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Tony Clifton was the alter ego of Andy Kaufman.
That's right.
So if you watch Man on the Moon, they talk about Tony Clifton on there, where Andy Kaufman would just dress up like a shitty Vegas lounge singer and. And whatever, so I did that where I had this wig, and then I had a mustache at the time, and I could do a really good Tony Clifton impression. So the reason why that's relevant is because the Zappa band, ZPZ, came to town right around, not around Halloween, but I had it as a Halloween costume, and I took it out to the show, and uh-huh. I dressed up like Tony Clifton, and I was walking around at the show.
Yeah.
I was already friends with the keyboard player, Chris okay. Norton, who's no longer in the band. But so I saw them playing Victoria. They were playing Roxy and Elsewhere live in its entirety. And there's a portion where the Bebop Tango, Frank would bring up people from the crowd to have them do funny little dances.
Right.
Right. So he would, people would come up and then do a funny little dance to George Duke's keyboard playing, whatever. So Dweezil was doing that. And then Chris was like, hey, was that you dressed up as Tony Clifton? I'm like, yeah, that was me. I dressed up. He's like, man, that's cool. He's like, you should come on stage tomorrow. And, and do that while we're playing the Bebop Tango.
Nice.
And so I ended up at the Vancouver show in front of like 1,200 people. I came to the show early. I met Dweezil in the backstage area.
Yeah.
And he's like, so what do you want to do? And so I was like, I can't tell you in my regular clothes. I need to go put on my costume.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to the bathroom, I put on my costume and I came out, and then I just started insulting him. I was like, hey, were you Dweezil Zappa? Yeah, I love your band. Grandpa plays grandpa. What are you, like 50? You know?
Right.
I was saying shit like that to him.
Uh-huh.
And he's laughing, he's like, oh, I like that a lot. So when we did the Bebop Tango live, I came out on stage, they gave me a microphone, and I came out and I just started insulting the band. I started insulting I started insulting everybody and just like tearing them a new asshole. And then the keyboard player played the notes, and then I basically went insane at the keyboard sounds, and then I tore off my costume, and then I was born a virgin Zappa fan. And
nice.
So that was my connection to the Bebop Tango and to the band itself too.
Wow.
I'll send you that video. It's pretty funny, although pretty outrageous too.
Oh, amazing, man. Oh my God. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Good stuff. I think you might have actually told me that story the last time we talked, believe it or not.
Oh, boo. Well, I'm sorry to repeat myself, but it's definitely relevant for all the Zappa talk that we're having. Yeah.
That's all right. Absolutely. Fuck it. I mean, I'll just leave it in just because it's so relevant. But the other record, obviously, and honestly, man, maybe my favorite with some of the songs. You mentioned Inca Road. So on One Size Fits All, obviously, that's the opening song. You have Florentine Pogan, San Bernardino, Andy. I mean, Evelyn, a modified dog is a little strange. the last track, Sofa Number Two, where Zappa's doing his crazy German shit, is it's wild. But my God, some of the songs on One Size Fits All, my God,
yeah, so beautiful. I was always a fan of the Sofa Number One and Number Two.
Yeah,
just the melody is so nice. You know, it's really pretty. And San Bernardino, that one has a good hook. Inca Roads is just like a really interesting piece of music.
Yeah.
And it's got a really great vibe and like lots of peaks and valleys to it and everything like that.
Totally.
And then that song Andy's really cool too. It has almost like a at least it starts off like it's a like a gospel or like it's holy or something like that. Ah, da da da, ooh, da 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 da. You know, there's so many beautiful moments on that record, and I love the artwork too.
Right,
the artwork's great.
It's wild.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, yeah. What a fitting cover and just package for such a wild album. Man, it's amazing.
Man, I'm just reminded of a lyric off Inca Roads. So what is it? Did a booger bear come from somewhere out there just to land at the Andes? Was it rounded? Did she have a motor? Or was it something different? Guacamole Queen, Guacamole Queen, Guacamole Queen. At the Armadillo in Austin, Texas, horror. Or did someone leave a space for chess? Ah, or did someone build a place to leave a space for Chester's thing to land?
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, you know the part I'm talking about.
Oh, absolutely.
About, right?
I'm amazed that you just knew the lyrics and could do that. Jesus.
Well, yeah. Well, it also helped me learn the part as well, too, because they do it on the marimba like about a minute and a half before the vocal part.
Right.
Where it's just like And so I was like, wow, that's so crazy, what's going on? And then I'm like, oh, they sing that same melody about a minute and a half later.
Right.
And so like from a percussion point of view, I was able to like be like, okay, just memorize these syllables and memorize the words, and then like straight up just translate it to the drum set. You know what I mean? I mean, you can orchestrate it however you want, but these are the kinds of lessons that I would learn just like listening to his music, because it's all up for interpretation, you know?
Right. Totally, man. My God. Mm-hmm. Right on. That was fun talking to you about those four records in particular. And I mean, my God, again, with so many records out there, you could pick any particular era, and there's just tons of records. Mm-hmm. And wow, it's definitely an amazing dude.
No doubt.
Well, I was gonna ask you about some of the, I guess, you know, modern heavy drummers that you've been digging. I, of course, really dig your playing. You mentioned Alex Rudinger. I really love his stuff. I dig what he did on that new Intronaut record.
Yeah.
It's always kind of insane watching like semi like Sebastian Lancer, you know, with Panzer Ballad, I guess, if that, or and Obscura,
yep.
Some of that stuff, and Eloy Casagrande of Sepultura as well. Yeah. That guy's such a savage. Are there any particular drummers, modern guys, that you've been kind of digging?
Man, yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, all the guys you mentioned, for sure. Like Eloy scares me when I watch him play. I'm like, oh my. God, look at him go. He's got such power and feel, and he's just like relentless and aggressive, you know?
That's amazing.
Yeah, he's great, that guy, like truly. And yeah, man, you know, there's like, I'm always seeing just like younger players who are just really doing really well and smoking. I mean, they're young, they're in their early 20s, and they can groove with the best of them, and they're kicking off some really, really fun, nasty kind of chops and grooves and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I got a cousin who's like a total badass, man.
Really?
Like his name's Johnny Kerr, K-E-R-R. Mm-hmm. I mean, if people want to check him out, give him a follow or whatever, but like, he's a legit badass, man. He's only like 21.
Wow.
And he's doing some like serious chops and grooving and just like really great articulation, with all of his strokes and really interesting ideas. And, I mean, I'm just like, holy shit. Like, I didn't sound anything like that when I was his age at all. You know, I'm like, holy shit. They're just, the bar is being raised.
Right.
But, you know, I don't listen or keep my ear to the ground as much as I should. And especially with metal.
Right.
I'm kind of one of those guys who likes what he likes. Yeah. Like without, I'm not narrow minded, but I also don't always like keep up with what's entirely new. So,
right.
I don't know. I listen to hip hop records. I listen to jazz records.
Yeah.
I listen to, you know, I listen to the greats.
Yeah.
You know, you have your Tony Williamses. Mm-hmm. You have somebody like Tony Williams. Like I'll listen to Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Of course.
And listen to Billy Cobham.
Oh yeah.
I always get inspiration from someone like Matt Garska, who's just so good at what he does.
Totally.
And there's this band called Ethel Duath I'm a big fan of. They broke up a couple of years ago, but they had this, they were originally from Italy. They had this old Italian drummer who's now in his 60s.
Wow.
But he is, he was a jazz drummer playing in a metal band, and his name's Davide Piovisan. He was great, just like playing jazz in a metal context and making it a true marriage. You know how people, they're like, hey, it's like a jazz part in a metal song, but usually it's kind of like, it's like one and then the other, you know, instead being well and truly a good aesthetic blend. So that guy really achieved that.
Nice.
Fiona Apple Records, really cool. She's always had great like percussion and, and stuff like that on her albums that I really dig.
Is Matt Chamberlain on this one as well? Do you know?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think it's this lady named Amy something, who I've never seen like any of her stuff like online. Like I don't know much of her of her presence online or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I do believe that she was her touring drummer for a little bit.
Gotcha.
And I think that she was one of the engineers, one of the recording engineers on the record. Her name's Amy Eileen Wood.
Okay.
And she's a great drummer.
Nice.
Geez, who else? Whom else am I? I mean, I'm stoked about all, you know, just like metal drummers in general when I hear them. Adam Jarvis, for sure, we can shout out to him because I know he's the man.
Totally.
Dave Whitty, I was always a fan of Dave's. Of course. I'm always a fan of Gene's.
Yeah.
You know, Thomas from Meshuggah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Danny Walker, the old drummer for Intronaut.
Oh, yeah, he's amazing.
He's a fantastic drummer.
So good.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I had to learn his drum parts and Alex's for that show that I did with them. And that was super, super challenging, but very, very worthwhile pursuit.
I bet.
You know, because those guys are awesome. Yeah.
Oh, man, that is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Damn, dude.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
Absolutely. Well, man, I know you, as you said earlier, you've been doing Skype lessons, so I'll be sure to include that information so people can contact you and hopefully hook up a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, man, it was a fun hang. Maybe we'll get to do it in person sometime in the not so distant future. And
yeah,
we'll have a beer actually like person to person. It'll be amazing.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. We could have a virtual beer when we're done this if you want to. But
totally, right?
Yeah, I hope I didn't ramble too much. I mean, when it comes to someone like Zappa, I could like sort of talk all day, and same with drums and everything.
No, it was great.
But yeah, I appreciate the time, and I love your podcast, man. It's awesome, and you interview some really great guys and gals, and you got a great sort of outlook on shit and enthusiasm. So yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome, Ash. Thank you, man. All right, everybody, thanks for tuning in. Thanks to Ash for catching up. Always down for a Zappa geek out, and always killer to talk to Ash and pick his brain about the many facets of his drumming and his approach and everything else. Dude stays cool, calm, and collected amidst the chaos. Something to aspire to. We'll catch y'all on the next one. Crash, bang, boom.